books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we're taking some books into the garden. Ruth Scurr tells us about Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows. Wanty Dawn tells us about sensory gardening, and Victoria Bennett discusses All My Wild Mothers, Motherhood, Loss, and an Apothecary Garden. All that, plus we've got some new books on all things gardening in the RNIB library. Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows by Ruth Scurr is a portrait of Napoleon written for our time, not in power, politics or epic battles, but through his love of nature and the gardens that gave his revolutionary life its light and shade. Napoleon's gardens range from his childhood olive groves in Corsica, to Josephine's gardens and menageries in Paris, to gardens in Cairo, Rome and on Elba, to the walled garden of Hougomont at the Battle of Waterloo, and ultimately to Napoleon's final garden on St. Helena, where Chinese labourers built him a summertime house where he could sit and scan the sea in his final months. The audio version is read by Tanya Kubrick.
After he was sent into exile on St. Helena at the age of 46, gardening was Napoleon's last burst of activity before he died. On the advice of his doctor, he made an elaborate garden where sunken paths helped him evade the surveillance of the British guards. He swapped his iconic bicorn hat for a battered straw one and set about cultivating the only patch of ground remaining to him. His interactions with the natural world at the end of his life resonate with those of every man or woman who enjoys gardening in retirement or in retreat from the stresses and strains of the world. But Napoleon was no every man. Earlier in his life, his relationship with nature was determined by his ambition. First, to advance himself within the chaotic aftermath of the French Revolution, and then to become the most important and feared man in Europe. Even in exile, there were echoes of grandeur in the extensive and meticulous plans he laid out for his last garden.
It's a biography that follows him through his life, the rise of his power and the decline of his power, by tracking him through the gardens that he passed through.
And the gardens themselves, the size of those reflect the size of his power.
Absolutely. So we start off with a very tiny garden when he was at school. Also the mulberry nursery that his family had on Corsica. And gradually move through larger and larger gardens, some in Paris, one in Egypt when he's on the campaign in Egypt, until we get to the grandest garden scheme of all, which is to construct a huge garden at the centre of Rome and also one connecting the Louvre and the Tuileries Palace in Paris, and finally to have a new palace on the banks of the River Seine and going to have an immense garden to go with that as well.
Napoleon spent 5 years at the military school in Brienne-le-Château and 6 on St. Helena. These blocks of time enclose his life like bookends. They are the periods during which he had little control over the conditions of his everyday life and found refuge in growing plants. In between his first and last gardens, the arc of his life rose towards the sky before falling back down to earth. As his power grew, then declined, he rarely had time for gardening himself, but he passed through many gardens, large and small, public parks or private green spaces, admiring them. Often he ordered improvements, commanding other people's labour, always imagining a grander garden than the one that existed.
As part of your research, I know some of them never existed or some of them won't exist anymore, but did you visit as many of the gardens as you could?
I did, and then COVID came, and I had just visited Fontainebleau. So I had previously been to Elba, but I haven't yet made it to St. Helena. Very much want to do that. But a friend of mine, his son was posted, he was a police officer in the Met, and he was posted to St. Helena, and his father went to visit him, and just a week ago he showed me the photographs, and I could recognise a huge amount of what he was showing me from the descriptions that were left by Napoleon's staff and the memoirs of that garden that he created there.
He was a garden watcher and enthusiast, alert to the science and art of cultivation. He valued gardens as places to walk in at his own pace, and he reflected on the frenetic events by which he hoped to secure the future of France. For someone almost always in motion and in a hurry, more often at war than not, gardens offered rare opportunities for calm and pleasure. They were a counterpoint to the many battlefields, discrete settings in which the terrain and the weather were as important as they were in combat, but for creative, not destructive purposes. On two significant occasions, one at the start of Napoleon's career, the other at the end, a garden became a battlefield and the distinction was lost. The first was the Tuileries Gardens in central Paris, where in 1792 he witnessed the massacre of Louis XVI's Swiss Guard and the fall of the French monarchy. The second was at the walled garden of Hougoumont at Waterloo. In both these gardens, the piles of dead and mutilated bodies formed a terrible contrast with horticultural attempts to impose order on the natural world.
Now, the audio version is read by Tanya Kubrick. Did you have choice in the narrator?
So they send, if you're not going to do the audiobook yourself, they send some samples of people who they think would do a good job, and then you choose one of those.
Have you done any of your books yourself?
No, not yet. I would be prepared to, but so far I haven't been asked to.
Now, one thing we don't get when we download the book from the RNIB Talking Books Library is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us? Because it's quite an unusual image.
I was thrilled by this cover. So it was designed by a man called Eric Wilder in the United States. And I always credit the designer because he did such a beautiful job for me. And what he's done is to take two very famous images of Napoleon, one him leaning on the spade in St. Helena, and he's got his straw hat in one hand, and that behind that is the iconic image of Napoleon crossing the Alps from the David painting, and that's in silhouette on the background. And then he has put green, and the cloak Napoleon was wearing is green to reflect the gardens. It was just a beautiful, imaginative response to the book, and I was so grateful to him.
So it's more a book about Napoleon the man rather than the emperor.
Yes, but obviously, you know, it covers the period where he is emperor, and you see him changing from being the young soldier, he's almost a sort of soldier of fortune, and then becoming emperor is part of the story. But it's actually quite a relatively brief time that he's emperor, and then there's the fall, and then there's the exile afterwards.
Almost a decade later, despite his dismay at the violent outcome of Napoleon's power, Coleridge proposed a series of lives from Moses to Bonaparte of all those great men who in states or in the mind of man had produced great revolutions, the effects of which still remain and are, more or less, distant causes of the present state of the world.
Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows by Ruth Scurr is available now as an ebook, in print and in audio, as read by Tanya Kubrick.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
Down to Earth, Gardening Wisdom by Monty Don was donated by DK Audio.
Know and go with the seasons. Do not fight them because you will lose. This will not always be convenient, so learn to be flexible. and measure the seasons by your own backyard. When is it spring in your garden? How does winter lie there? At what point precisely is the shift from spring to summer? These are real questions and have precise answers that are different in every garden in the world. It is your autumn, your east wind, your shower of rain. There are not many Americanisms that I like, but the one which I love is the word fall for autumn. In every way, it perfectly suits the season, with its falling leaves. The degree of colour change in fall is dependent upon late summer weather, when hot days and cold nights stimulate the production of chemicals closely related to carbohydrates that produce red pigmentation. The leaves convert starch to sugar to feed the tree, but cold nights stop it moving from the leaf back to the roots. This accumulation of sugar in the leaves often results in red pigmentation. And as the green chlorophyll begins decomposing, as the days shorten, so the red comes to the fore. The greater the difference in temperature between day and night, in other words, the hotter the days between late July and early August, the more extreme the leaf coloration will be.
Unrivaled gardening wisdom from Monty Don, including essential tips, knowledge and musings from his 50 years of gardening experience. This is Monty Don right beside you in the garden, challenging norms and sharing advice. Discover Monty's thoughts and garden ideas around nature, seasons, colour, design, pests, flowering shrubs, containers and much more. Hear about the month-by-month jobs he does in his own garden, which he hopes are relevant to you. Monty's warm voice brings this most intimate book to life, an enriching listen for any gardener.
Leaf mould is always useful, and you can never have too much. It's low in nutrients, but excellent for improving soil structure. This makes it very useful in homemade compost and as a mulch for woodland plants, as well as a general conditioner for heavy soil. For some reason, no one has ever commercialised it, although there's no reason why they shouldn't do so. It is, after all, much easier to gather fallen leaves and make leaf mould than to rip up and destroy rare peat bogs to market the peat. However, unlike good compost, which needs turning regularly and has to be made up of a mixture of ingredients to get the right balance, leaf mould is the easiest thing in the world to make. Garden compost is created by a mixture of bacterial, fungal, invertebrate and insect activity, stimulated by heat and oxygen, which is why you turn it. But leaf mould is largely made by fungal activity and is cold insofar as it doesn't need heat to spur the fungi into action. You just gather up the leaves, make sure that they're thoroughly wet, put them to one side and let them quietly get on with the process of decomposition.
Down to Earth Gardening Wisdom, written by Monty Don, runs for 7 hours and 39 minutes and is read by the author.
Give it a grow. Simple projects to nurture food, flowers and wildlife in any outdoor space, by Martha Swales. Was given to us by Penguin Random House.
12 years ago, on the first sunny day of the year, I found myself at Kew Gardens. As a child, I'd been before, but this was the first time I'd been there of my own volition. At the end of the afternoon, I arrived in the shop and stood transfixed in front of a huge wall of seed packets, full of potential. I picked 5 or 6 packets more or less at random. Off I went back home to sow them, the small beginnings of what would grow into an all-consuming obsession. I've always been prone to great enthusiasm for new hobbies, and having sown my aubergine seeds and carefully placed them near the radiator, I would often sit on the floor next to them, constantly checking for signs of life. Once my seedlings raised their delicate heads above the soil, the next task was to find a home for the new lives I had ushered into being. My mum has a beautiful garden, which she has been tending with great skill and patience for over 40 years. My new obsession with vegetables and her carefully landscaped and masterfully planted garden were not immediately happy bedfellows. I started with pots on the sunny deck, grow bags, old crates lined with plastic bags, anything and everything I could find to grow food in. After running out of space on the deck, I began to spread further afield, putting large grow bags directly on top of my mum's lawn. That summer, I harvested wonky broccoli, sunshine yellow patty pans, knobbly, thick-skinned cucumbers, and one very small, beautifully glossy, black aubergine. Her hand having been forced, the following year, my mum dug up the dismal remains of her lawn and replaced it with the most beautiful flowers. Tall trumpets of Nicotiana, the heady scent of valerian, elegant stems of Verbena bonariensis, and the vibrant pink Catherine Wheel faces of red campion, all of which still grace the garden every year over a decade later.
The Ultimate Beginner's Guide to Growing Veg, Fruit, Flowers and Nurturing Wildlife in Your Garden, Patio, Balcony or Windowsill. In this practical guide, Martha Swales makes it easier than ever before to start growing your own slice of nature with her collection of foolproof projects. You don't need expensive tools or equipment. Martha's approach is all about getting outside, trying something new and watching the magic of nature take its course. Grow garlic greens on your windowsill and use them to make tasty garlic flatbreads. Create a tower of tumbling strawberries. Build a pond to bring wildlife to your garden. Make a bulb lasagna for a changing display of flowers throughout spring. This is the perfect book for anyone who wants to get more out of their outside space, to enjoy the taste of their own produce, or to simply feel more connected to nature. Why don't you give it a grow?
Few things in my life have changed it as much as those seed packets from Kew Gardens shop. Growing food is not just about harvests, although they are of course nice. The seeds grew into an enduring fascination with watching life unfold as the seasons roll by. The unpredictable turns of weather, sunshine, rain, drought, cold, with a million tiny dramas being played out by ants and leather jackets, worms and tadpoles, birds and bees. It's accurate to say I became truly obsessed. And rapidly the space afforded to me in my parents' garden was no longer enough for the grand plans forming in my head. And so it was that I got my first allotment at the age of 23, a sprawling, overgrown plot on the outskirts of London. In my 20s, I moved house half a dozen times, but wherever I was, I would make the pilgrimage to my allotment to battle weeds and grow food, and every spring there would be new grand plans. Always comfortable with verging on the eccentric, I kept the key on a string around my neck and would tell anyone who would listen all about growing food. In the office, I was caught on more than one occasion shopping online for seeds when I was supposed to be working. As I've grown older, my single-minded obsession with growing food has broadened into a greater appreciation of all plants. And these days, a new flower opening its petals in my garden, bringing with it pale pinks or yellows, bright orange, deep purple, heady scents and hoverflies, elicits a childlike joy in me.
Give it a grow. Simple projects to nurture food, flowers and wildlife in any outdoor space. By Martha Swales. Runs for 5 hours and 42 minutes and is read by the author. As you've just heard, Monty Doane has a new book in the library, joining many others that he's published over the years. When he was promoting his book about a French garden odyssey, I asked him if he preferred writing about gardens or filming Gardener's World.
I much prefer writing about gardens than talking about them on telly. Much more frustrating to do it on television. Because when you write about gardens, you can write about anything. You can make it as long or as short as you like. You can describe things that aren't happening in front of your eye. You can describe things that happened in 1662 and 1837 and yesterday and last autumn and next year. On telly, you can only show what there is to be seen. And also, you've probably got about 2 minutes to do it. Writing books is freedom. Writing books is me saying what I want to say. Television is the art of compromise. I mean, it's an interesting art and one that I love, but all television is about trying to cram at least a quart into a pint pot, and usually more like a whole great big milk container lorry into a pint pot. So in other words, you're always whittling down. And then you see, when it's filmed, about, up to three quarters of what we film will be chucked away. And at least a third will be chucked. And I have no control over what is thrown and what is kept. I'm not in the edit suite. Very often, what I consider to be my best work is never shown because there might have been sound problems or the images may not have quite worked, or it was just felt that it didn't quite fit. in with other things. So that's the downside of filming. The upside is you're working as part of a team of experts who are very good at their jobs, and you are just one cog in that machine. Whereas a writer, you are the machine. It's you on your own. And a book like this one, I sat where I'm talking to you now in this room for, I wrote it very fast and very intensively because it had years of notes, and then I had spent the whole year traveling. But it still took me about 12 weeks of doing nothing else at all from morning till night to do that. And if I hadn't had a family, I wouldn't have spoken to anyone else. I would have had no other contact. So writing is any book. It doesn't matter if it's the great novel or if it's a book about dog grooming. Is a lonely, solitary, repetitive work. And what makes it good is when it comes alive, when it becomes fantasy, when what's in your head goes onto the page. From gardening, see, gardening, you're working with nature. That's the whole thing. You're not trying to, it's a terrible mistake that people make about gardens, which is trying to create a garden and impose it onto the landscapes or onto the plot. Good gardens, all good gardens, are the synthesis of mankind's creativity and the natural world's bounty. And at their most successful, they harmonize, sometimes in surprising ways, but they work together always. Mm. And I think when you're writing, it's a blank page. It's absolutely what you put on the page. Television, as I say, is a machine, and it's a team, and when it's good, it's greater than the sum of its parts. But you're still, it's an artifact. You know, you still can fiddle around with it and you can change things. Mm. Gardening is much more intuitive, much more responsive. It's a longer, slower, good gardening happens across years, lifetime. Increasingly, I feel that happen across centuries, you know, that my garden is just a layer, a very thin skin on this earth, and when I go, someone else will add another thin layer, and so it builds up. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the garden, I'm connected to thousands of years of tending this soil, and that's a very enriching experience. And other times, you're just dealing with one plant; it's very beautiful, mm-hmm. and you're looking after it. So I think gardening is, it is creative, and I think it can be an art form. And I think in gardening, as in most things, that people with good sight tend to let that have much more dominance over their other senses. But years ago, I wrote a book called The Sensuous Garden, which was all about using the different senses and how you can garden to make the most of them. And I suppose after sight, the most obvious one is scent. Because scent works on such a primeval way. It goes right to the oldest part of our brain. And as we know, scent and memory are inextricably linked. Because you can't recognize smells except through memory. There's no way of knowing a smell except through an experience. So, for example, you smell an orange, and you will identify it as an orange through something that happened to you in your past. And the two parts of the brain are exactly the same. So it's very personal and very powerful. And when we're designing a garden for scent, we should use that. Just think, you know, what scent do we want? It's not enough just to say I want it to smell any more than I want it to look. You know, we don't plant plants just because we want colour. We want to choose what colour. How do we want it to work? How's it going to affect us? Do we want a smell that's going to invigorate us or to calm us down or to remind us of our childhood or the day that we got married or you know, a perfume or a meal or whatever. Designing scent can really dramatically affect your garden. So A, include it as much as possible, and B, work on it. And also different times of day. So, for example, plants like tobacco plants only really smell in the evening. A lot of plants have oils which heat up during the day, then release their scent at night, particularly white ones, because that attracts pollinating insects at night on a warm day. So where are you going to be at night? You don't want those scents happening in a part of the garden you never go into in the evening. You want to be where you sit, and so on and so forth. So understanding that dramatically enriches one's experience of the garden. Taste is the other one that is clear, is, you know, we grow food to nourish ourselves, but it's got to taste good. It's got to have real taste. And as any keen vegetable gardener will tell you, only too willingly, no food tastes better than your own veg straight from the garden. Again, it's not enough just to say, oh, it's food. It's, you know, what are you eating? What does it actually taste of? What? Try and describe it. New potatoes from the garden taste much sweeter than any new potato you can buy, and that's because the sugars turn to starch very quickly. And so if you eat them within a few hours, they will be sweeter. And that's true of sweet corn, and it's true of asparagus and peas, which is why, you know, peas tend to be frozen in the field. So that maximizing taste, and that those are the two obvious ones, but the other two senses, which I feel we don't really use enough, are sound, particularly plants like grasses. When the wind catches them, they rustle and shift. When you have the leaves, I have hornbeam hedges in my garden, and at this time of year, just before they grow their new leaves, the old leaves are very dry and brittle. And when there's a slight wind, they patter. It sounds exactly like rain. And you hear this rain falling on a clear, bright day. And it's the leaf. It's a very particular sound. Frost has a sound when you walk it on the grass. Obviously, wind makes sound, and you can attract birds to your garden. Sound is really important. The sound of your footfall on a mossy, softer surface as opposed to a hard surface.
And the sound of running water as well.
Incredibly important. Really, really important. And the final one, which, again, we undervalue. I'm sure everybody's aware of it, but we don't value its importance, except for the people who are completely blind, is touch. You know, plant plants so that when you walk, you can trail your hand along and touch. And sometimes they'll have a scent. If you walk past a rosemary bush and run your hand down the length, you will release oils that will have, not only will you feel it, but you'll smell it. Other plants are very soft and feathery. If you have a box hedge, I've got a box hedge like just to, automatically, without thinking, I just brush my hand along the top of it as I pass. Touch, both on your hand, on your feet. Maybe you have a gap in the garden where you have to slightly push past very soft plants that aren't at all abrasive. This is all part of the language, the sensory language of your garden. And it doesn't matter whether you're sighted or not. To waste that opportunity, not to fully embrace it, is not to fully embrace the faculties that you have. It doesn't matter whether you're fully sighted or totally blind or partially sighted or whatever. Not to embrace all the possibilities of your senses is crazy. And people have this idea that, oh, if you're blind, then you need to develop your touch or your taste or whatever. I think that's just rubbish. I think we all do. You know, we all should use our senses to the maximum ability, and the best place to do that is in the garden. Just on your skin, you can feel a kind of air that hits you from different plants. Sometimes it's hot and bakes back, sometimes it's cool. That's all important. It's all feeding in, and the message. And some gardens that we love, actually, if you try to analyze it, we love it because it just feels nice. And that's about as articulate as you can get. I often walk around my own garden barefoot, silently. So just try and I would say to anybody, is go into your garden and don't try and see, smell, hear, or touch anything. Don't try and think anything. Just let it come to you. If you walk gently, let it come. And all kinds of things start flooding in and coming to you. It's incredibly enriching, but at the same time, restful experience.
Thanks again to Monty Don. And as I said, there's a healthy crop of his books available in the RNIB library, which have recently been joined by these two new books.
The Gardeners Club by Marnie Riches was donated by Penguin Random House.
For the last 15 minutes, I've been looking at the clock on the wall, and I could swear that time is actually going backwards. How can it be 5:42 p.m. when it was 5:41 p.m. about 10 minutes ago? Surely there's only another 5 or so minutes of this corporate torture, featuring free bendy biscuits and lukewarm hot drinks, dispensed from urns that have probably contained Legionnaire's disease since the mid-90s. I sip the dregs of my coffee in a bid to wake myself up. It tastes like a cocktail of Bovril and petrol. When I slam the cup down a little too heavily onto its saucer, my boss, Colin, turns from the graph projected onto the whiteboard to lock eyes with me. He continues to speak in that nasal drone of his. So, the main worry bead area is that average handling time of customer calls is too long, and we're getting very high call abandonment rates. These figures show not just a drop in first touch resolution, but, like the eye of Sauron, his never-sleeping gaze has moved on to Jess, my opposite number in the Birmingham call centre, and I've already tuned out again. My heavy eyelids know it's time to drop the shutters for the day on the vagaries of servicing the nation's insurance policies. Jill! Jill! Wake up!
Gardening is dirty work, but should it be deadly? When Jill Swanley decides to take up gardening to fight a midlife malaise, she never expected it to become quite such a dangerous hobby. Pushing herself to get out there, Jill joins the Bromley Botanists. Here she finds a 7-strong group whose main agenda is how to win the coveted Golden Trowel for Best Community Club of the Year. But when a dead body turns up in the community greenhouse, they suddenly have a more serious matter to consider than victory. They must uncover whether their arch rivals, Croydon, are taking things to another level, or whether someone more dangerous is targeting their ragtag group. Can they dig up the truth before someone else is left pushing up the daisies?
Let's give Marjorie a clap for her beautiful parrot tulips. A man's voice, followed by a sparse round of applause, drifts out to me as I stand on the threshold of the community hall at the side of an old red brick church. This place looks like exactly the sort of mildewed hellhole that I don't want to spend my evening in. Yet I take a deep breath, acknowledge that I'm just looking for yet another way out of improving my life, and will myself inside. I know I'm late, but I hope I can slip in at the back, unnoticed. I realise my plan is doomed when I see there are only 6 people sitting in the draughty hall, plus a stout grey-haired man at the front who is dressed in mushroom-coloured slacks, slung beneath a pudgy belly, and paired with a yellow polo shirt with curling tips to the collar. He hasn't noticed me yet. Through his outdated tinted glasses, his gaze is fixed on an elderly woman in a pleated skirt and floral blouse. He beckons her over. Marjorie, why don't you come up to the front and explain your winning formula for such incredible... He clams up as soon as he spots me and treats me to a faltering smile. Oh, hello. Can I help you? All eyes are on me now. I can feel the heat creeping into my florid cheeks, my recently acquired rosacea lighting up that dismal place. I'm here for the... Is this the Bromley chapter of the Golden Trowel thingy?
The Gardeners Club by Marnie Riches is read by Rachel Atkins and runs for 10 hours and 20 minutes.
The Lie of the Land, Who Really Cares for the Countryside, by Guy Shrubsell, was given to us by HarperCollins.
Some river campaigners have gone still further by declaring that rivers are not mere property to own, but have rights themselves. On Midsummer's Day in 2021, a group of Cambridge residents gathered to solemnly declare the rights of the River Cam, including the right to be free from pollution and the right to flow. The barrister, Paul Powsland, who helped initiate the declaration, has pioneered the idea in the UK that nature should have rights, as it has among many indigenous cultures around the world, such as the Maori people of New Zealand. Equally at home in smart legal attire or a pink jumpsuit, Powsland lives in a canal boat on the River Roding in London, and at weekends can usually be found picking up rubbish along its length or reporting pollution incidents to the authorities. "I relate to the river as a sacred entity," he says, "and I'm doing whatever I can to uphold those rights through law, campaigning, or direct action."
For centuries, we've been sold a lie that you need to own the land to care for it. Just 1% of the population own half of England, and this tiny land-owning elite like to present themselves as the rightful custodians of countryside. They're even paid billions of pounds of public money to be good stewards. But what happens when they just don't care? A small number of landowners have laid waste to some of our most treasured landscapes, leaving our forests bare, our rivers polluted, our moorlands burned, and our fenlands drained. Here, Guy Shrubsole journeys all over Britain to expose the damage done to our land and to meet the communities fighting back. The river guardians, small farmers, and trespassing activists restoring our lost wildlife. Full of rage and hope, this is a bold vision for our nation's wild places and how we can treat them with the awe and attention they deserve. It's time to demand better for nature. We can start by replacing the lie of the land with a profound truth that any of us can care for the countryside, regardless of whether you own it.
Such a philosophy is underpinned by the idea that if rivers can be deemed alive and granted legal personhood, then no one can truly own them, as we would nowadays shudder at the concept of one person owning another as goods and chattels. The sense that no one can own land, that we belong to the earth rather than the earth belonging to us, is a revolutionary one. But dispensing with ideas of ownership and giving rights to nature seems alien in a country like England, which essentially invented private property rights. "The UK is one of the hardest nuts to crack," Pausland says. "We are where the idea of nature as a resource originated." None of these activists own huge estates or great tracts of land, yet they care for land and water that they do not own. They love these rivers because they live beside them, use them, take pleasure in being near them. Still, if one is to develop such a deep love for a particular place, it helps to have access to it. Most of England's rivers are off limits to the public. 96% of waterways in England and Wales have no clear rights of navigation for kayakers and canoeists, and the laws surrounding wild swimming are as murky as the waters its enthusiasts swim in. The Wye is one of the few rivers to have clear access rights along its full length, in England at least. So it's no coincidence that this is where some of the most vocal campaigns against river pollution have arisen. Of course, this flies in the face of conventional wisdom, which argues that the public has to be kept out of the countryside for fear that they will mess it up with discarded crisp packets and dogs let off leads. As the nature writer and enthusiastic wild swimmer Amy Jane Beer writes in The Flow, her elegiac love letter to rivers, "In every access debate, you come across the entrenched idea that people who don't own land cannot be trusted to treat it well. This overlooks both the countless individual and community actions that actively benefit the environment, and the fact that plenty of people who do own land mistreat it appallingly."
The Lie of the Land, Who Really Cares for the Countryside, by Guy Shrubsole, runs for 8 hours and 58 minutes and is read by the author.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And finally today, let's hear from Victoria Bennett on her award-winning book, All My Wild Mothers, Motherhood, Loss and an Apothecary Garden.
All My Wild Mothers is my debut memoir, although I've been writing for many years, since I was a child really, but writing poetry and publishing it for many years. This is my first book with so many words, is what I say to people. So it's my debut memoir, and it was written over a decade of care and grief. So it was written between the hours of those things, and it weaves together herbal folklore, kind of traditional wart cunning medicine, and personal memoir about grief and motherhood, loss, and the physical act of planting a wild apothecary garden with my young son in our new home, which was on a social housing estate in Cumbria, a new built one. And it had been built, the estate had been built over old industrial ground. So we were planting into what was essentially just layers and layers of rubble, because the industrial ground had been a former stonework. So it not only had what had been the industrial buildings underneath the topsoil, but it also had 2 centuries of stoneworks rubble under it as well. And we grew that together on no money, just really with growing what would grow in this ground. And it was really the weeds beneath our feet that grew it. And we learnt together what properties they had and the folklore and the medicinal uses. And we grew food there as well. So it's about what grows, not in spite of what's broken, but because of it.
And what actually made you turn this journey into a book?
I didn't intend it. I think my intention wasn't a book at the beginning. Life was passing by very quickly, and I had been deeply in grief for the first years of my son's life. And also, I was also a carer for my son, who was diagnosed at the age of 2 with type 1 diabetes and was very, very sick because that had been missed for quite a while. And I decided that in between the care demands and the grief and all the rest of it, and just the day-to-day, I wanted to try and put down on paper, put down in words, the moments we were having. So I would, whenever I had a moment, I would light a candle and I would sit at my desk and I would write for as long as I had until I was called to do something else. And then I would blow the candle out and I would get back to what I needed to do. And sometimes that was 10 minutes and sometimes that was 2 minutes. And the chapters vary in length, I think, possibly reflecting the way that it was written. And it was about trying to put into words the things that had gone in my life. So because of loss, the things that had passed, and also to capture or to get as close to the moments I was living. And then after a long time, it became a book.
Who was it you were grieving?
Shortly before my son was born, or 2 months before my son was born, my eldest sister went out for a very undramatic canoeing trip to the River Eden, which she did frequently, and frequently canoed this stretch of the river. And she was in an accident and the canoe capsized and she drowned. So that changed everything in my life, and it was shortly before my son was born, so his birth became something that was tied forever really with a loss. And then in the years that followed, we experienced other losses in my life as well. So we lost other members of our family. It became really sort of 8 years of grieving one after the other.
So did that make it quite a hard book to write, or was there a certain catharsis there?
I think I didn't write the book as a therapeutic thing. I didn't start writing about my sister's death until this point. So obviously she had died 4 years previously. Although some of the writing that went into All My Wild Mothers was written at the time as journal entries that I went and revisited. But it wasn't so much a catharsis as the opportunity to write closer to the whole experience. You know, when a shocking, I think when any death, but when a shocking death happens, the emotions are so intense, so acute that I found I couldn't really write. I couldn't create from it. You know, it wasn't something that creativity would be cathartic for. I just had to live through it. But in writing it later, I was able to not only write about the grief, but remember my sister, remember moments from our lives together, and equally so remember moments from my childhood and my life, my family life, and this whole network of women and people around me, and revisit those memories that were at first glance maybe a bit like the ground under the garden. They were kind of rubble, but then revisiting them and writing into them allowed me to find the things that were growing there, and the joyful moments and the beauty in there, and it cathartic in that it gave me back a lot of joy that had been lost in the shock of the grieving.
I'm worn down and tired of failing to be the lover, the mother, the woman I thought I was meant to be. What little energy is left over from loss is exhausted by the constant pressure of debt. We are offered austerity as the cure. But it is harsh-lipped and cruel, cutting the safety nets from those who need them most. As the politicians talk of tightening our national belt, my husband worries about being a good father, about providing for his family. He's frightened that he will not be able to support us. He says that he should get a real job. I tell him that being an artist is a real job, and what we do matters, that we will survive as we always have. But we don't live in a culture that values what we can give, and it gets harder to do. The work gets less, the pay lower, the distance to travel further. He spends longer away, trading in the days of our son's early years for the hope of security later on. An echo of my own childhood days.
Right, let's get to the garden in All My Wild Mothers. What sort of things grew in the rubble?
So all the plants that are in the book, by the end of the 10 years, were growing in the garden. And they range from things like dandelion and rose bay willow herb, all the way to bluebell and red campion, broadleaf dock, sow thistle, lady's mantle, horse chestnut, foxglove. A lot of the plants in there would be the kind of things, and were the kind of things, that people were digging out of their own gardens and didn't want in them. And we claimed them and said, we'll plant them. And then we gathered seeds where we went as well, and sowed those. So we ended up with a variety of wildflowers, as well as some trees, sort of cherry and apple and greengage, and then other plants that we would rescue from the bin lines of shops, you know, when they were bedraggled and nobody wanted them. So we grew huge lavender bushes out of these tiny little bedraggled lavender stumps that we planted at the beginning. We had different areas in the garden as well. So we had a pond and a bog garden and a little woodland area and a micro meadow and a sort of a micro forest and a vegetable planting area and a desert area. Bearing in mind, this is just in a small social housing estate garden. So they were micro areas, but we tried to make it as biodiverse as possible, partly because of an intention and partly because when the garden was planned, it was largely planned by my son, who was he would have said 4.5 and a bit at the time. The bit was very important.
Now, you said that it didn't start out as an apothecary garden, but it became one. So what did you actually use the plants for?
Well, I'm not, you know, I qualify myself in saying that I'm not a, you know, I'm not a licensed herbalist. I wouldn't be able to use plants to treat anybody else. But I return very much to the use of plants in how they would have more traditionally been used as part of our day-to-day knowledge. So for a practice that I have is that I go into the, I've just started doing again now in Orkney because I'm just starting to plant a new garden, but I would go into the garden and just see which plants kind of intuitively pick the plants to blend into a tea through the day and kind of just drink that. So that would be a kind of more generalized thing. But again, I know what's growing in the garden, so I can do that fairly safely in terms of being able to identify things by smell and touch and sight. So intuitively picking plants, if you don't know what you're picking, is probably not wise. It's always good to find out what they are. But then I would also use specifically things like mint for digestion and feverfew for headaches and catmint for relaxation. I must be part cat, I think. But, you know, as the garden grew, we learned more. I mean, I had a basic knowledge anyway when we started, and we learned more over the years. And obviously, because we were growing what was by and large weeds, those are the plants that have the, you know, you'll find many of them at the base of a lot of medicinal or herbal treatments and herbalism. And in fact, a lot of modern medicine. I mean, foxglove, for example, you wouldn't use in its herbal state because it's incredibly toxic and dangerous to use. But it is the basis of modern heart medicine. You know, these weeds are what used to be our medicine chests.
You mentioned smell and touch. So would this garden be of benefit to someone with low or no vision?
I would say so. I mean, I think one of the beauties of wild gardening, because of the biodiversity of it, you get the sounds of the insects that it attracts. So you've got the bees, you've got, you know, I mean, there's so much sound in a wild garden. So you've got the wildlife that comes to the garden. You also have the sounds of the plants. So, I mean, one of the plants I love is honesty. They have the seed heads. They're sort of quite large, about the size of a 50 pence piece and flat and smooth. And inside they have these flat, smooth seeds. And they have several of those on a thin branching stem. And in the autumn when they're seeding, they rattle when there's a breeze. So you get this wonderful percussion, and the same happens with a lot of grasses and things. So you have a percussive garden, and you have, you know, layering onto that, you would have the sounds of the insects, which, you know, ranging from like the deep thrum of a bumblebee all the way through to the kind of the cricket type sounds that you get in the grasses. And, you know, we ended up having frogs, bullfrog in the garden, so we had that deep sort of booming bass. And so you've got an orchestra in your garden. And you've got the birds as well, obviously, so it attracts all the garden birds with all of their different songs that come in. So you've got these vocalists coming in as well. So, you know, a wild garden itself, it is like going to a concert in the Royal Albert Hall, I think. But then you've also got smell. So a lot of wildflowers won't rely on smell. You know, they tend to be much more kind of bright colors or things that will catch the insects. So they use a different tactic, but some of them do have, you know, great smells. So obviously the lavender bushes that we had in the garden, we put in the front of the house where it was the worst ground because they love growing in terrible ground. And the children on the estate used to go past and to school, and as they went past, they would always brush their hands along the lavender. And when the postie came to deliver post, they would have to go through the lavender bushes to get to the door. And everybody used to say how much they loved that, because it would release this smell of lavender into the air, which, you know, so often is a nostalgic smell for people, a nostalgic scent. It brings back, you know, these memories. And you've also got, you know, the earthy smells in the grass with clove. You know, if you're allowing things like clover to grow in your grass, then it produces this, you know, this rich smell. So if you're lying on the grass, you've got this earthy scent, and then the mints and the herbs growing in create this freshness. So I could go on.
But what do you think's your favourite part of herbal folklore then?
My favourite part, I love the names. You know, I in writing the book and in gardening, in Created Garden, you know, I looked into a lot of the common names. And they tell so much about the plant and their uses. But also, I find it really interesting because they tell you a lot about both how they grow, so the kind of botanical aspect of it, but also their medicinal uses that then are later proved in scientific studies. So the book starts with the plant rose bay willow herb. And I'm not even going to attempt to try and say the Latin name because I just can't get my tongue around them. But the common names are passion fire and bombweed. It's a pioneer plant, and it grows best in scorched ground. So it's one of the first plants that will appear in ground that's been burnt. And it got its name bombweed because it grew in the bomb craters during the Blitz. So when London was blitzed, suddenly these tall, willowy, pink-headed, beautiful plants started growing in the craters out of the rubble and the destruction, which I think is such a beautiful kind of combination of both telling us what the resilience of the plant, but also about that hope that comes in resilience of what can grow once something's been destroyed.
Victoria's book, All My Wild Mothers, is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And for that full interview, head to Read On, number 320.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.